All right, Dirk Chatelain from the World Herald is going to join us here in a little bit. Today is the 14th anniversary of the firing of Steve Peterson. It is also an anniversary 12 years ago. Josh, do you remember where you were as you got word that in the state of Colorado there was a six-year-old boy that had blown away?
The Jiffy Pop balloon,
yes,
kid, yeah.
And that everybody was riveted to. Now, this is one of the first events that collectively as a group on Twitter we're talking about. But as the Jiffy Pop balloon is floating through the skies of Colorado, and Wolf Blitzer, I was watching CNN at the time, is describing this, and the just horror that people were going through. Unbelievable. They could not understand how this could happen. And oh my God, the six-year-old boy that was in it. And then after it lands and they immediately rush to the balloon and there is nobody inside. And then, as they say, the gig was up. And back to Wolf Blitzer. Hard questions to the family. And it was the kid who actually outed the family, actually outed dad. Yeah, that happened back in 2009. That seemed like 12 years ago.
Feels like a lifetime ago.
Everywhere I went that day, as this was going on, people were watching. Yeah, it was 12 years ago that the six-year-old boy flew away. The balloon crashes. There's nobody inside. And then the six-year-old boy gives up dad. Happened back in 2009. All right. Dirk Chatelain of the World Herald joins us now on the Lanaha Nurseries hotline. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. I as you were reliving and sharing your experience of trying to find your wife's vehicle in the parking garage at Epley, I first thought of, okay, we've been there before, but maybe not in a parking garage, but at a ballpark or a stadium where there's thousands of cars and you forgot where you parked, or the Seinfeld episode where they lost their car in the parking garage.
Thankfully, I was not carrying a goldfish. but it's just funny how much you come to rely on the lock button.
Yes.
You know, the beepers. I guess I just sort of took it for granted that I'd be able to find this thing because of the beepers, but the beepers don't help you when you are in the wrong parking garage 500 yards away.
Yeah. You know what? Your wife left out that little nugget of information. But as you said, I mean, if people haven't been to Epley, and a lot of people haven't flown since the pandemic started, Epley looks a little bit different. The new parking garage is finished. Yeah, I could see you wandering around. Now, did anybody stop you and say, hey, can I help you? Or, you know, because we've all driven by those people and go, oh, man, I'd hate to be them.
No, although I did have a look of desperation basically the whole time. I had to go to the bathroom. I was hungry. I had a friend waiting. I had to get my kids off the bus. It was all sorts of variables lining up to make it a harrowing experience. But, you know, it was, big picture, a bit of a first world problem. So I made it out just fine.
But you're right. What did we do before the panic button on our remote starter or our lock button? I mean, how did we ever find our car?
We weren't stupid enough to, you know, to go on a mission like that without having a precise location. I can tell you that. So sort of adding insult to injury was when I finally got a hold of my wife and she texted me a photo of, you know, where the car was, you know, under the 3V. And it's like, gosh, I really could have used this like an hour ago.
Before we talk about last Saturday, because we were both there and the emotions of a classic brand game and the result, earlier this week, because we both lived through it, we're going to do the beginning and the end. What are your memories? And Mitch Sherman and Max Olson did a great job of going back through the 41-day search in 2003. What are some of your key memories of that fiasco that lasted over a month to find the guy to replace Frank Solich?
So I was a I was like the senior in college, 22 years old. So I was sort of 1 foot in, 1 foot out. I was kind of covering it from a college newspaper perspective. And so I was there for a lot of it, but I wasn't necessarily covering it like hour by hour. Most, you know, the moments that really jump out, one are I actually rode the elevator up with Steve Peterson and Harvey Perlman when they were going up there, not with Bernard Thomas on the way down. But I was going up, and just that press conference was bizarre. You know, Peterson's line about surrendering the Big 12 to Texas and Oklahoma, and it just, man, it felt like a momentous decision, right? Like, mm-hmm. I mean, it was not one of these things. Sometimes we look back in history and we're like, man, that was a really big moment in hindsight. That one, you knew it was a big moment watching it. So that one jumps out. And then the other one that really stands out is Peterson calling the press conference a month later, to basically tell everybody that the process.
That was on that Saturday afternoon, right?
He basically told people that it hasn't started yet. You know, it's like, no, we, this is going exactly how we planned. And it's like, gosh, man, just. If there are moments in life where I think it's better to just fess up and tell the truth. And there was always a sense, you know, and you heard rumors about it for years, and I think some people's sources were more reliable than others, but there was always, you know, a belief that whoever Peterson had pinpointed had kind of let him down or had backed out at the last minute. And the Mike Sherman thing that The Athletic reported makes a lot of sense, because it would have been a splash hire. It would have really dropped people's jaws to hire the Green Bay Packers head coach. But at the same time, I read that and I was just like, Steve Peterson, what were you thinking? Like, Mike Sherman was never going to leave the Green Bay Packers for the Nebraska Cornhuskers, especially, you know, the timing was bad. Like, mm-hmm. it didn't make any sense. He was the general manager. Like, and I think it really spoke to Peterson's fatal flaw, which was just this ego that where he really thought he could, you know, he could lure a guy like that to Lincoln. And obviously he didn't have much of a plan B, and that was the other fatal flaw in the process.
Now, the Saturday press conference, there was a women's basketball game that was going on. That hastily called press conference was just mind-boggling. I was like, what is he doing? This is such a mess. And it was, you know, by then, Nebraska was a laughing stock all around the country about what was going on.
Yeah, and then, to be honest, and the story spoke to this, but he really got lucky with Bill Callahan. I mean,
needed a job.
At least he could spin that, you know, as, hey, this guy just coached in the Super Bowl, right? And I think he sort of represented what Peterson was trying to do, which was modernize the program and, you know, juice up recruiting and all these things. So the irony is he actually got lucky, because waiting that long, he kind of fell into somebody that he could at least spin. I actually think it would have been worse had he hired Houston Nutt, because, you know, how do you sell that, right? It's like, you just fired Frank Solich and you hired a guy from Arkansas whose record was worse. Like, how do you, I don't even know how you would have done that. So, you know, as bad as it went, I think it could have been even worse had he hired Houston Nutt.
14 years ago today, Steve Peterson was fired.
Today?
Yep.
That brings up a memory, too. Okay, so I want to, you know, go where you want to go. But so, but that Tuesday afternoon or whatever it was, I walk into the administration building at Nebraska. And it's, you know, Perlman's office is at the end of the hallway. And I'm going in to try to talk to Harvey, or at least observe what's going on in Harvey's world. And as I'm approaching Harvey's office, Steve Peterson walks out of the office. Ooh. And he walks down the hallway. And I, you know, I said, it was just me and him. Mm-hmm. And I said something to the effect of, you know, Steve, can you stop and talk? And he said, no, I have another meeting to go to. And Perlman had just fired him. Like, it was, you know, wow. It happened right there. So I didn't realize today was the anniversary of that.
So did you make it down the rest of the hallway to Perlman's office?
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, neither one of them, you know, Harvey was, I think he went over and addressed the media, I don't know, an hour later, 2 hours later, something like that. But that was, I think that was the last time I saw Steve Peterson in person. And the other part of that day that I remember is he had a Husker flag that he always waved or flew from his porch on Sheridan Boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of known for that. And that night, it was dark. I do remember that. I remember going over to his house, and the Husker flag was no longer hanging from the porch. So just an unbelievable, almost like, you know, something that you would create in literary fiction of a hero come home who failed spectacularly. Mm-hmm. because he really just, I think he thought he was capable of more than he was actually capable of. It's a pretty good lesson. I'm not saying he's alone. There's a lot of people that have had big ambitions who have tried to, you know, save a situation and actually made it worse. And I think that's, you know, that's ultimately what Peterson did. I think the big what if, you know, there are lots of what ifs, but one of the big ones is just what happens if he gives Frank one more year? I don't think it would have gone better for Frank, but I think it would have made it so much easier. I'd be really interested in your thoughts. I think it would have made it so much easier to sell it to Nebraska's fans if he just would have given it one more year. Because I think it, you know, it just became so difficult to move on from that just because of how contentious it was.
It was, from the time he took over, the Independence Bowl, he's standing on the sidelines, you know, by himself, to, you know, him and Frank didn't have hardly any communication during the 03 season. You could see the writing on the wall. It's an interesting time period for him as the athletic director at Nebraska. Now let's fast forward 14 years, and in that same spot, a guy who didn't have as much experience maybe as Peterson had, Pittsburgh compared to Omaha. Don't you feel now, and kind of how this last month has gone with the ups and downs and our as Nebraska close and where this program's going, that you feel like there's more stability for a guy that's been there for 3 months in Trev running the athletic director office?
Yeah, I think there's a couple advantages he has. One is he's just been around, you know, for quite a while. I think that helps, you know, as opposed to someone parachuting in to the situation. So I think he was more aware. I mean, this is going to be a little bit clunky, but the contrast between Trev's arrival and Scott Frost's arrival, where I think a lot of Scott's understanding of the situation was based on what people had told him, as opposed to first person observation, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think Trev's advantage was, over the last decade, he was able to watch this thing kind of, you know, flail and fail, with his own observational skills, without having to rely on other people's perspective. And I don't think Scott necessarily had that benefit. So I think it's easier to come in and really kind of understand the situation and know what to say and what not to say. I think Scott made some mistakes early on in what he said publicly, and I'm sure the things that he did, you know, privately too, where he just, you know, I'll give you an example. I mean, some of the comments about Mike Riley, I don't think that was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he felt like that was those were things that needed to be said or the fans wanted to be said. And I don't think that was helpful. Trev Alberts has not made those types of comments. And again, I think it's a benefit of being around it more the last decade. The other part that has been really critical to his stability, as you call it, is just the credibility that he carries as being part of the program, right? It's much, much easier. I mean, we did the Big Red Breakfast 9 days ago,
with Trev, yeah,
or 2 weeks ago. And we're sitting there on stage together, and he's making criticisms of the athletic department.
Hmm.
there's no doubt. I mean, if he's criticizing the way things were run, he's criticizing, you know, certain leaders and the culture and all that. But he has credibility to do it because everybody understands that, you know, he's, quote, one of us, right? And I think that is, that's been a really important part of his success over the last few months, is just that, you know, the credibility factor. If a guy comes in from the outside, if Jamie Pollard comes in and makes those same comments, everybody's going to, you know, their eyebrows are going to jump because, you know, that's an outsider. And is he right? Is he wrong? What is, you know, what authority does he have to say that, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the being, you know, part of the institution in the 90s really has given Alberts the stability and support that he needs to say what needs to be said and to understand what doesn't need to be said, yeah. Which is, by the way, just as important.
I agree. That's perfectly said. Dirk Challen from the World Herald joining us. People got excited because I thought the Mad Chatter was back, but they're not going to label it as Mad Chatter. But some scattered thoughts on multiple things, and it starts with Adrian Martinez. Every conversation about Nebraska football is essentially about Adrian Martinez until that chapter is closed. How would you describe, you know, you've been around this for a while, where not everybody is Tommy Frazier, not everybody is Eric Crouch, not everybody is Zach Taylor, who, you know, that's, people loved Zach Taylor. You know, people love Joe Gans. How would you describe this fan base relationship with quarterbacks that are not just one-year starters but are here for a while, like a Taylor Martinez, a Tommy Armstrong, or now a four-year starter in Adrian Martinez?
Well, I think there is an element of fatigue with these guys. I think that was true with all three of the ones that you just mentioned. There's a sense of, gosh, is this guy ever going to leave? He's been around forever, you know, in the same way that you get tired of a coach or a president or a spouse or whatever. You know, people just like to see new faces in prominent positions. And I think there's an element of that. But I also think that people understand that he's probably the best player that Nebraska has. He's the best player that Nebraska has, and yet he's often the guy who makes the critical mistake that prevents Nebraska from winning. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting situation. And I think, you know, if Martinez, I still think there's time for him to sort of rewrite the narrative. If he beats Ohio State or Iowa even, I think people, you know, let's say he beats Ohio State, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And this is his last year. I think people would remember him quite fondly. But until he really gets over the hump and wins a big game and does it in sort of a spectacular fashion, I think there's going to be a sense that, you know, that this guy just isn't quite good enough. And I'm sure that's frustrating for him, for coaches. I know it's frustrating for fans. But you know, you mentioned Taylor Martinez and Tommy Armstrong. And the other thing that really jumps out to me about those guys is while they were around for so long, you know, 3-4 years, all three of them, they didn't really get better. You know, that's the odd part to me, is it's like, I mean, can you really say any of those three guys? I mean, I think Adrian is clearly better than he was.
Yes.
Even, you know, I'm adamant about that. He's better for sure. But I'm not sure he's considerably better based on what he was 2 or 3 years ago. I'm not sure he has, you know, followed the trajectory that you would anticipate. And I think the same is true of Tommy, and I think the same is true of Taylor. So that's kind of weird too, right? Is mm-hmm. It's like Nebraska fans were excited about these guys as freshmen and sophomores even, and they were kind of the same player, you know, 2 or 3 years later. And I think that adds to the frustration.
What'd you think of Saturday night? What'd you think of that atmosphere with, you got the Michigan helmets, the Nebraska helmets, you got Harbaugh on one sideline barking at every person that was wearing stripes. What do you think Saturday night means moving forward?
Well, I told somebody this early in the week, but I was surprised at how positive the response to Saturday night was. And that is true for my own observation. I mean, my own feeling. On one hand, it was obviously devastating that Nebraska almost, you know, beat undefeated Michigan on primetime and Memorial Stadium. But I think because it was such a well-played second half, because, you know, it was generally evaluated as a good football performance, you know, Nebraska mm-hmm. didn't embarrass themselves, and they didn't lose it because of a special teams gaffe. I mean, yes, it was a weird play at the end, but Nebraska showed a lot of guts and a lot of talent. And I think people were just so happy, so like satisfied, emotionally satisfied to have that kind of experience in that environment. And it really felt kind of like a throwback, you know, maybe not to the glory days, but certainly to a time period when Nebraska hosted big games. I was struck by how positive people were on Sunday. And we'll see if that carries over. I mean, Nebraska, you know, still has to, they got to beat teams like Minnesota, and eventually they got to get over the hump against teams like Michigan and Ohio State and Iowa. But I thought it was a really positive step, big picture for the program to have that type of opportunity and to sort of, after a rough start, to kind of meet the moment. And I thought Nebraska fans, you know, should be proud of that.
Yeah, and they might get an opportunity here in a couple of weeks, depending on what Nebraska and Ohio State do. We might get to do it all over again in primetime on that first weekend in November.
That would be a lot of fun. I think, you know, Ohio State carries a little bit more intimidation for good reason based on their experience. But I still think that, you know, Nebraska has a formula here with a really good defense. Didn't play a great game Saturday night, but still a really good defense. And they have a very dangerous quarterback. And usually those two components will keep you in games against just about anybody.
Yep, I agree. Dirk, as always, I appreciate it. Thank you. Have a good weekend.
All right, take care.
It's Dirk Chatelain from the World Herald. Another element of Saturday night. I was told this when I was walking out with somebody who, and then their son and their wife went to the game. And so we were walking back to our cars, and they were sitting in one of the end zones, and their eighth grade son said, "Dad, it was going to be cool because I was going to run on the field and help everybody tear down the goalposts." So this apparently was something that Michigan mentioned in the fourth quarter. Harbaugh, this is a story that kind of came out after the game that is being backed up. You know, Michigan's in a bye week this week, so media availability isn't on a regular basis. But Michigan, apparently during one of the timeouts, Harbaugh told his either offensive or defensive guys, I haven't gotten clarification on who it was, look around the stadium and look at the people because they're going to run on the field and they're going to tear down the goalposts. They're going to tear down the goalposts and carry them out of the stadium. And his quote was, "Not on our watch." So Harbaugh thought people were going to storm the field. Nebraska beats Michigan, they're going to come on the field, they're going to tear down the goalposts. I think that was real. I mean, goalposts haven't been torn down in Memorial Stadium in a long time. I got an eighth grader saying, "Yeah, man, it was going to be cool. I was going to go on the field and I was going to tear down a goalpost." And I said, "Yeah, right, by yourself." But Harbaugh thought the same thing. He thought, or at least he wanted to use that as motivation. In one of the timeouts in the fourth quarter in which he had his team on the sidelines, he said, "Look around. These fans are going to run on the field and they're going to tear down the goalposts." And he said, "Not on our watch." Future between Nebraska and Michigan will be a little spicy, which is okay. That's what the Big Ten needs. The Big Ten needs some spiciness. We've got Iowa and Penn State that have added some spiciness. It's okay. Minnesota, Nebraska. Tomorrow we'll have a little spicy to it on both sidelines. That's the Big Ten needs that kind of stuff. The SEC gets that. The Big Ten very rarely has that. But we're getting it now, and that's okay. That's okay. It can't always be the spiciness of Ohio State and Michigan. It's okay for other teams in the league to participate in that. All right, 125. Take a quick break. Come back. Thoughts on how Nebraska navigates the 10,000 lakes. And they steal the oar, and they row the boat, and they win tomorrow, and they go into the bye week 4-4. Mentioned at the top of the hour, Eric Chenander, who lost his father in an auto accident yesterday in Iowa, will coach tomorrow. So Nebraska's defensive coordinator will be in the press box for the 11 a.m. kick between the Gophers and the Huskers. We're back with more of the Gary Sharp Show on a Football Friday Fiesta after this.